From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today we learn about the field of epigenetics, which tells us our actions can have long-term genetic consequences to future generations. Then our new fitness contributor offers some advice for people who just joined a gym this year.
But it's the exposure to the gym, given a whirl. Get past the soreness area of the first 2 weeks and continue if you like it. If you don't, find an activity you do like.
We remember rock and roll and Harley historian Martin Jack Rosenblum, who died this past weekend. And the author of End of the Rainbow explains why he wanted to write about Judy Garland at the end of her career.
Not only do you have that really dramatic, compelling situation and a fascinating, complex woman, but you also have an opportunity to bring all her music into the show and to see her perform and to hear those songs.
Lake Effect comes your way next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in today. What do you know about genetics and how our genes are passed down? Well, you're probably aware that the things we do to our bodies, like smoking, and the things that happen to us, like malnutrition, can influence our offspring. But to what extent? It turns out scientists are really only starting to grasp how the changes to our genes can have a long-term impact. The field is called epigenetics, and some significant work in it is playing out in Milwaukee. Dr. Rob Lane chairs the pediatrics department at Children's Hospital of Wisconsin and at the Medical College of Wisconsin. He tells Lake Effect's Mitch Teich that for all we know about how DNA shapes us, it only tells half the story.
An easy way to think about it or to see a good example of it is all of your cells have the same DNA sequence. But obviously a hepatocyte, a liver cell, and a brain cell, a neuron, are very different, despite the fact that the DNA sequence is exactly the same. The reason that they're different is this concept of epigenetics, that your body is capable and your cells are capable of three-dimensionally regulating the sequence to determine what genes are expressed. And what genes are expressed determines what those cells do and how they function.
Well, and I gather there are some genes that are expressed, and then there are some that kind of lie dormant. Is that right?
Absolutely. You need different genes at different times, and that's one way to regulate it. And that's sort of the beauty of epigenetics. I do a lot of cooking as my hobby, and it's like having that one pan that you can do a lot of things with. Epigenetics can function on a very static level. It's what keeps your neurons, your brain cells, neurons forever. You don't want your brain cells changing. So it's a very hard-wired system. On the other hand, epigenetics is also responsible for your minute-to-minute, hour-to-hour variations in gene expression as you adjust to the world. So there's a lot of flexibility in how epigenetics works in some parts of your genome and in some mechanisms, and others that it's very concrete and similar regardless of who you are.
Well, and so we've known about the concept of the epigenome for some time now, but there are obviously strong inheritance linkages in the development of DNA. But how much of the epigenome in a newborn starts from scratch, and how much is inherited or influenced by past generations?
That is the spot-on question. And the belief at this point is that it absolutely is affected. The question, of course, is how much is it affected, and can you reprogram, if you will, some of these differences? We really don't know. And the reason we don't know is that it's so hard to take the scientific method to epigenetics because there's so many things in play. So when we do studies on humans and we see differences in epigenetics, we don't know whether they are markers of something that's already happened or they are the actual cause. And going back and testing that is one of the great challenges.
I know there are a couple of large-scale studies involving famines that have that have demonstrated at least what appears to be a link.
Right. And this is part of what's often been called the fetal origins of disease hypothesis or the Barker's hypothesis. And the classic study that sort of started into the scientific community's consciousness was the Dutch famine. And the Dutch famine occurred at the end of World War II, and there was a very regulated decrease in calories, about 600 calories per day, regardless of who you were. And what was observed, two things. The first is in that generation, based on where your mother was in the pregnancy, you had a statistical increase for different adult diseases, even though you have survived the famine and you've eaten fine because the war was over. We're now seeing, even in that second generation, that there are some differences. If your grandparents suffer through the famine during with a pregnancy, again, there seems to be these long-lasting effects. And certainly, of course, multiple other famines. The Chinese famine is one that we don't write about as often. There's evidence that if your family member experiences an incredibly biologically stressful event, it will affect health 2, 3, 4 generations later.
But at the same time, your epigenome is evolving in its own way as well, right?
Right. And that's actually one of the great challenges in it, is that not only do you have your epigenome that hardwires things like the type of cells, but you also have all your cells have different epigenetic profiles. Based on our genders, we have different epigenetic profiles. There are even differences based on where you grew up. So trying to pull out that information and understanding what's real and what's noise is the challenge. That being said, as we all have the goal of having population health and personalized medicine, which are interrelated, the epigenome, because of its complexity, is one of the aspects of biology that if we figure it out, if we use the computational power that we have, that there is the possibility to explain or allow for the variation in the complexity of human existence and actually be able to predict the risk for disease.
So you might be able to say, as you look at a patient today, well, this person's mother or father or grandfather mm-hmm. was exposed to such and such a factor, so he or she might be at higher risk for disease A, B, or C.
Right. And we may even be able to take it a step further. Based on some of the patterns we see in the epigenome, you may be able to say that we know there's a risk just on that exposure, but there's even a higher risk, and that's worth interventions that have some risk to them by themselves, but the risk of the disease is greater than the risk of the intervention, so we should intervene. And in contrast, that person who doesn't have that increased risk based on what you see in the patterns of the epigenome, you don't have to do those interventions that are either costly or potentially risk-inducing.
One of the things that popped to mind as I was studying about epigenetics and getting ready for this interview is the idea of the similarities in identical twins and how they might begin to differ as they age. Is that epigenetics at work?
That is epigenetics at work. One of the things that was helpful to us, because when we started doing epigenetics about 15, 20 years ago, it wasn't considered very hip. We were told we were being Lamarckian. And that change, one of the first observations were is that identical twins do differ in terms of their epigenetics. And the farther apart they get, the more differences there are.
Is there something to the idea of witnessing evolution at work in this field?
Absolutely. That's where we get to the Lamarckian concept, is that in many ways it shows just how doggone bright the Celestial Design Committee is, in that this is a way for us to have some plasticity in our development, to adjust to our environment. If we go back to those famines, one of the things that's been speculated on is that if you do experience this famine, it tends to program you to those adult diseases we don't like, things like obesity, hypertension, diabetes. But if you think about it, thousands of years ago, if you were going to anticipate as a fetus, as a baby, a bad environment, you would want to program yourself to store lots of fat, because if you do get a chance to eat, you want to keep it with you. Our brains depend on glucose, and so you would want to make the rest of your body insulin resistant so that you have as much glucose as possible to your brain, because that's what really makes a difference. And you want to be just a little bit hypertensive, because that's going to allow when you're running for you to run faster and perfuse the things you want to perfuse. If you live to the age of 20, it's not that big a deal. Now that we live to the age of 50, 60, 70 and enjoy custard, it becomes more of an issue.
Well, and so this really does sound like, think of evolution playing out over, epochs.
Yes.
But this is really scaled way, 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 way back.
Yes. There's a plasticity to this that it's almost a generation by generation response. And that is what's so attractive to it in terms of being a physician is because if you can help somebody, if you can decrease a risk by adjusting epigenetics, so we know we can do that with diet, then you may be able to affect the outcomes by an early intervention in childhood of those adult diseases that so plague us now in the U.S.
And those seem like relatively reachable goals. I mean, you would be in a better position to weigh in on that than I would. But I wonder, way down the road, are there implications for how we actually might treat disease? I mean, are there implications for medicine itself? Might we be able to go in and manipulate the epigenome in a way that we talk about doing, you know, genetic engineering?
There are. And I guess for me, I think of it in three different potential waves. One is the concept of either life course or lifestyle medicine. And epigenetics really provides a paradigm that if we want to treat adult diseases, for example, we need to pay attention to what's happening in childhood and what's happening in pregnancy. And epigenetics provides a platform for that. The second component of it is that we do know that diet makes a difference. And we can show that. We can be objective about it. And so we can get a better understanding of who's going to respond to changes in diet. Where we should go and where we're hoping to go eventually is exactly what you said, is can we change our epigenome? And the key to it is because different cells, different tissues respond to these general sort of shotgun interventions like diet. But there's the possibility that we will be able to affect the epigenetics of specific genes and specific cells. And so if you can do that, you can almost do gene therapy without some of the long-term risks or consequences that we are so concerned about in terms of gene therapy now.
This is a ways down the road, though.
This is a ways down the road.
Well, Rob Lane, thanks for giving us kind of a reality check, a primer on epigenetics.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Dr. Rob Lane chairs the Department of Pediatrics at Children's Hospital of Wisconsin and at the Medical College of Wisconsin, and he's a specialist in the field of epigenetics. He spoke with Lake Effect's Mitch Teich, and you can find links to much more about epigenetics from wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Coming up next, we'll jump on the fitness bandwagon with a new monthly segment on everything from working out to eating right. Join us when Lake Effect returns with our new contributor, Ken Weber, right after this. Lake Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. We heard before the break how our weight can be affected by choices made in past generations. But of course, it can also be affected by you and what you eat and how much you exercise. Overall, Americans now weigh more than ever. We have more diseases brought on by lifestyle choices, and many of us have an unhealthy relationship with food. The causes of all of this can be and are debated ad nauseum. What to do about it on a macro level can be equally frustrating, with advice from thousands of sources only adding to the confusion. What can be done on the individual level, though, is more addressable. Lake Effect's resolution this year is to bring you a new segment that will address concerns about fitness. From diet to working out, from carbs to calorie counting to crunches, we'll try to present it all. There's a lot to explore when it comes to getting fit, and there's no one-size-fits-all approach. So to help us stick to our resolution, we're calling on Ken Weber. He's the owner of Brickyard Gym in Bayview, a business he started in 1983. He's accumulated a treasure trove of fitness knowledge as he's maneuvered through the many trends that have come and gone. He says he's still learning, though, and that we should all keep learning when it comes to being healthy. He tells Dan Harmon about the unusual event that got him started.
I injured a shoulder in a brawl I was in, and I had a surgery, and the doctor says, well, you should start lifting weights. And I thought, oh, this is perfect. I'm a Phi Ed major. I want a better physique, and I have to do rehab. So it started, Dan, with rehabbing my shoulders, going to the weight room, and discovering how good the weights felt and the movement after having the surgery on my shoulder. And I caught the bug, enjoyed it, enjoyed what it was doing to my body. So I continued after my therapy was completed.
And when you first opened your business decades ago, was that the focus of it? Or is it, if you look at your business now, can you say that it's about fitness or bodybuilding or each of the above?
My focus was to stay in business. I bought the gym on the premise that I was never going to go out of business. I wanted to be successful. I like the idea of being my own boss, money was very, very minimal when I first started. I was putting a lot of money back into the business. So I worked another part-time job while I owned it. So my focus in the beginning was I enjoyed it. It was my hobby. I got to know some of the guys that were at the gym I was at, and it seemed like a good fit, Dan, that I just kept it going, and I honored the memberships. And because I worked out, I thought, well, if I'm working out anyway, why not own a business that I enjoy? I'd be there anyway.
And you started that gym before the, or around the time anyway, of this kind of national craze and fitness center chains. And there was this kind of quiet, I thought, revolution going on about fitness, and it was becoming a more formalized thing to do. Do you think that you were ahead of the curve when you decided to do this?
I think Arnold, when he came to the States in the late 60s, early 70s, put a name and a face and a personality to bodybuilding and made it popular and made it something to do other than just football players. It became more popular in the 70s because of the fact that it was more acceptable, and the changes in the body Arnold brought to the scene. A lot of men my age admired that, and after starting to work out, you want to achieve some sort of muscle eccentric look, because part of it is I don't want to be a normal person. I want to be somebody that, oh, look at that guy. And it not only feels good, but it makes your body stand out from others.
Well, before your business started and before we had national chains, I mean, there were always local gyms, and to me, it seems like it was more focused on bodybuilding. It wasn't necessarily focused on the average person becoming more fit. It was more about how you looked, right?
Correct. Now, the gym started because of the crave that Arnold brought, and then the chains jumped on board, seeing that there is a market for the average person to go to. European Health Spa and Victani and Bally's were the leaders in this kind of revolution. And more people caught this fitness bug, used it as a supplement, even if they were in other sports, saw that it supplemented their other sport and made them better. And it just became a money-making thing for the chains, and it's doing very well today. Many of the chains are very successful.
It just seems like the trend coincided with, you know, the more unhealthy we became, the more we're eating junk food and too much of it, and too much of any kind of food, that coincided with the rise in fitness centers. It just seems really, well, suspicious.
Also, the automation. Our society became a little more at ease. Some of the physical jobs were going by the wayside. And I think people behind a desk were realizing, okay, the eating habits got a little wrong, so let's do something with our bodies because we're not physical enough during the day. And it swayed a lot of people to look for fitness centers or health clubs or gyms like mine.
And also, somewhat seems like the rise in pop, sort of a kind of pop culture that really just idolized kind of this younger, slimmer, fitter physique, and that really kind of just boomed, you know, late 70s, early 80s during the kind of the video era. It's not that it was a TV era, but that kind of focus on the body really hit back then.
Yeah, that is correct. Yeah, there was a more awareness and a need, and a lot of the modeling agencies would call and say, hey, we need this and that for this promotion. So it was put out there more, Dan, and people were more aware that they need to either work on their physique or go for a better one. And that's why a gym is so much fun to belong to, because you can be your own artist. You're an artist with your body.
And you've been doing this for so long, and as was mentioned in our intro, you're going to be our monthly fitness guru, or the person we're going to turn to for advice and knowledge about fitness. And I think you're uniquely qualified in that you've been involved so long in the industry. So let's talk about our first subject. I would like to just – it's a new year, and a lot of people have made resolutions that they're going to be healthier, and that could take any number of forms. That could be a nutrition-based idea, commitment, or a fitness, or both. What do you think about people that do New Year's resolutions? And they sound good and they're well-intentioned, but then reality hits and then things go wrong in a lot of cases.
New Year's resolutions are great for gyms because the promotions are on the air. People are getting into the new year, a new start, and just to think about, hey, I need to do something, whether it's diet or exercise, is a great start for somebody to realize that you can be better. You can have a better waistline. You can have a better physique. You can actually feel better. And 9 out of 10 resolution people at my gym quit. But the thing is, they started, they were aware, they may go on to other activities. But just being aware and doing something and trying something is a win. That one person that makes it after the first 3 weeks or a month goes on to a new, healthier, and a different lifestyle. And the other 9 may try again next year, and one more may come aboard. But it's the exposure to the gym, given a whirl, get past the soreness area of the first 2 weeks, and continue if you like it. If you don't, find an activity you do like, because movement and exercise will give you longevity, will give you a better quality of life, and I highly recommend it.
What is it that you think people do in their New Year's resolutions that's just a bit too much? I mean, I think people are perhaps overextending their commitments or trying to do too much too soon. What do you think some baby steps are?
Yeah, a good point. Some people hire a personal trainer and will use them. But baby steps are just finding the time, looking at a gym or a health club, not making a big commitment. You don't have to take a year or two. Make a month commitment to that health club and observe. Start on the treadmill or an elliptical and just watch the people. Watch the people that have the physiques you want to attain. See what they do. We don't work out hard. We don't sweat. We don't kill ourselves. A lot of us are having a really good time working on our physiques. We get our endorphins going. We laugh. We help each other. We encourage each other. I would say the main thing, Dan, is the patience of the person getting into a fitness program to sit back and observe and watch and be careful with your body, because the first week or two can be very, very sore if you overdo it and may sway you to quit.
And, of course, I'm asking a gym owner this question, but you don't actually have to go to a gym. I mean, there are things you can do just to get yourself out of the house or just to start dipping your toe in this area.
Absolutely. There's plenty of very good home equipment gyms that are available at the different fitness stores online and on TV. Get out and walk. Take a longer walk with your dog. Rollerblade, winter activity, snowshoe, cross-country skiing. But it's an activity you set aside, and you start by committing to it, not going to the ball game or putting this off or that off, because that's when it snowballs, Dan, and people quit. You have to make it a priority at first, and then it becomes enjoyable, because not only do you feel better, you're exercising your body, but you're seeing results in your cardiovascular development and also your muscle tone.
So I think you might just say people should do something, whether it's joining a gym or even just trying yoga or going for walks, even though it's, you know, been super cold lately. Now it's better, but you can go for a walk in the winter, right?
Absolutely. Right. Yes. And it's good you brought up the yoga point, because as I see, I'm 57 now. And when I started working out, I was 19 years old in college. My eating habits were different. The way I trained was different. My recovery is different. Now that I'm aging, I can relate to what happens to the body as we age. What do we need? What do we have to do more of? What do we need as nutrition? So it's kind of neat to see myself evolve, because I'm learning all the time too, Dan, on what foods to eat, how to exercise my body, what's wrong with some of the muscles that aren't responding. You have to become better stewards of your body as we age.
And we're going to talk about all of these things and more in the coming year. And we'll talk about, you know, what's good for people over 40. What are some mistakes people make? We'll talk about yoga and all kinds of things that are related to health and fitness and nutrition, of course. But what are some things people can do with nutrition? You just mentioned that. What's a good nutrition resolution for the new year?
Dan, I tried every diet out there, and I'm sure my gym members are going to be listening and laughing, because I tried the fruit diet, I tried the low carb diet, high carb diet, high protein, low fat, high fat, and the raw diet, and vegetarian, and Boy, what's a good diet? That is an awesome, awesome question.
Or just a few things to think about with food, you know, things that people can try that aren't total commitments to a diet.
What I'm finding, Dan, is the better quality or the rawer you eat the food unprocessed, the less you need. Say your fruits and vegetables have enzymes and things in them to help you digest them. They fill you up and they don't put the fat on. They give you energy. What I like to do is design my diet around energy. How good do I feel while I'm eating it? How good do I feel afterwards? And how does that sustain my energy level throughout the day until my next meal? So it's a lot of experimenting for me too, finding out what foods actually are easy to digest and produce energy in my body.
Anything that you think people are, what are some big mistakes people make? You know, some people go for the radical approach when the new year is here and they want to try any number of diets, but I think maybe some smaller changes are in order.
Yeah, that's a good point too. Start with small things, leaving the butter off the baked potato, then skipping the sour cream, and maybe just adding salt and pepper and getting used to the way the food tastes with all the not all the extra addings to that, leaving the butter off the vegetables, and then maybe not cooking them as much or steaming them or having them raw, but just little things, cut out syrup, cut out whole milk, things that are just full of fat and not doing your body any good. Maybe cut down on your red meat. Younger generation, your body still can handle red meat. As we age, our bodies become less adaptable to actually digesting red meat. So you want to maybe cut that down a little bit. I'm not saying cut it out altogether, but just see how you feel with less. And lean chicken and lean fish, very good foods to eat. But I like to try to stay with fruits, vegetables, homemade vegetable soups, and meat only when my body is asking for it.
Well, I can't wait. We could have a whole hour-long show on diets, or maybe a week-long.
Absolutely.
A five-hour show on diets, so we'll talk about that in the future. All right. Any parting thoughts?
I'm excited. I like to share the knowledge, and I'm learning too, so we'll learn and explore this topic together, diet and exercise and body awareness. I'm thrilled to be here and help people be aware of their body, how much better they can feel. And age is not going to be a factor. We're going to get into things that you can start doing. I'm 57. I'm learning new things and reflexology and hanging upside down by my knees and just new things opening doors for me. And I'm excited to share those things.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Ken Weber. We'll talk to you in February.
Thank you.
Ken Weber is the owner of Brickyard Gym, and he is our new monthly fitness contributor. Find out more of his biography and the history of the gym in our supplemental audio section on wuwm.com/legeffect. Weber spoke with Dan Harmon. Coming up next, we remember Milwaukee rock and roll historian Martin Jack Rosenblum, who died unexpectedly over the weekend. That's coming up next when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. It's Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks for joining us.
When you get to Milwaukee, you know it's a pioneer town.
Noted Milwaukee rock and roll and Harley-Davidson historian Martin Jack Rosenblum died over the weekend. He was the founder of UWM's certificate program in rock and roll studies. He was also a prolific musician and songwriter. He served as a mentor and inspiration to many Milwaukee musicians and academics alike. Rosenblum spoke with Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke in 2011, shortly after the Rock and Roll Studies certificate program was launched, and we revisit that interview now. Rosenblum talked then about the program's two tracks, the music itself, and the cultural significance of rock and roll, and whether you can study one without examining the other.
I would contend that you cannot, and this has to do with one of the issues that is so important in an academic setting, and that is not only understanding the music, but also the cultural placement of it. And the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee Peck School of the Arts Music Department, to the best of our knowledge, is the only spot in higher education that offers this type of program.
Which is not to say, I mean, I know there have been some kind of piecemeal rock and roll history classes out there, but you're talking about a comprehensive program that sets this apart from just a class on rock history here or there.
You are entirely correct, and forgive my passionate response, but many of these classes to which you are referring do not connect the subject matter appropriately to the past. They don't relate it appropriately to the present and are, in fact, not following appropriate musicological pedagogy.
I know classical music has, of course, been widely studied and appreciated and dissected in academia. But as you say, this is really the first comprehensive approach to rock and roll. Why do you think it has taken so long to put rock and roll under an academic microscope?
That is a brilliant question. And one of the things we say about the rock and roll certificate is that it takes as serious approach to American oral tradition music as has been traditionally taken relative to classical music. Why has it taken so long? I think that the answer to that question is that we're very innovative in the Peck School of the Arts music department, and we understand the importance of American vernacular music and really sought to create an appropriate pedagogy for rock and roll specifically. And rock and roll is, yes, what the certificate program is called, but remember, I've already identified that we take a very thorough and detailed look at the evolution of what oral tradition music was before it becomes known as rock and roll.
And it seems like you wind up with just maybe a simplistic debate about whether Bruce Springsteen's lyrics actually are poetry.
I mean, yes, you have nailed precisely what the issue is. His lyrics are not poetry. They have literary aspects, and one must go to Bob Dylan for the instigator of literary aspects within rock and roll lyrics, Bruce Springsteen being someone in that lineage. But to study it as poetry is not appropriate. Now, speaking of Bob Dylan, what Bob Dylan does is, in 1965 specifically, engage in a very significant and changing narrative shift, whereby he brings in attributes from what we would generally agree upon as being American free verse poetry. But we're still dealing with song lyrics, and it's different. One of the classes in the Rock and Roll Certificate Program is Music 300, the literary aspects of rock and roll, which very carefully studies country lyrics, blues lyrics, moves into 50s rock and roll lyrics, and then, most importantly, moves into the lyrics that have literary significance from 1965 and thereafter. And Music 300 differentiates between American free verse poetry and song lyrics in order to achieve perfect understanding of what is literary or poetic, in quotes, about certain song lyrics after 1965.
Makes me remember an old Doonesbury strip where an unseen Bob Dylan is telling somebody, "I just wanted to make it rhyme, man."
Yes, 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 of course.
Is there a risk you run in studying this too closely that you could inadvertently wring some of the joy out of it?
Absolutely not. That risk does not exist. Because of the approach taken in every single class, whereby the appreciation of the music itself is not trampled upon. In fact, it is enhanced. I'm very careful regarding this particular issue, and these classes do not run that risk. If anything, upon completion of these history classes, one would have a greater appreciation.
Is there work that you need to do in getting your students past their subjective appreciation for rock and roll, their likes and dislikes, if you will?
Yeah, we do have to discuss how likes and dislikes have not only contaminated a listener's sense of history, but also have contaminated many critics who are writing from the perspective of fandom and not from the perspective of appropriate critical apparatus.
Is there any one single skill set that you hope the students who go through this program come out with?
Yes. I would hope they would come out with a better sense of American oral tradition music history. I would hope that their likes and dislikes perhaps would strengthen and that they would understand exactly why they prefer certain music that they are calling rock and roll. But I would also hope that they would eliminate some of the music that they're calling rock and roll from that which they like and dislike and begin to understand it from a more educated perspective that, as I've already identified, to me, should provide a greater enjoyment. In other words, I would hope that when one finishes the certificate, one hears a song and its precedent, musical identity and cultural identity, so that we have a more informed and more educated listener.
Martin Jack Rosenblum recorded in an interview with Mitch Tyke in September of 2011. Rosenblum died unexpectedly over the weekend. Before his death, he was senior lecturer in music history and literature at UW-Milwaukee's Peck School of the Arts, and he ran the school's certificate program in rock and roll studies. He was also a historian for Harley-Davidson and was the author of 20 books of poetry and more than a dozen CDs of original songs, including the one we're hearing now. It's called Walking Through. He sings and plays both the guitar and harmonica on it. A memorial for Rosenblum will be held this Thursday, January 16th at 3 p.m., taking place at the Music Recital Hall at UWM. There's more information at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. We'll take one last break and then head to the Milwaukee Rep to talk with the playwright, star, and director of End of the Rainbow. Stay tuned. Lake Effect returns in just a moment on Milwaukee Public Radio.
When the stairs begin to shake, who's that walking through? It can't be the devil. It's gotta be me or you.
It's Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. The word icon is tossed about pretty freely, but it's safe to say that Judy Garland was and is one. She was described by Fred Astaire, no slouch himself, as the greatest entertainer that ever lived. More than 40 years after her too early death at the age of 47, her art and her life, fueled in part by drugs, alcohol, and unhappy relationships, remain fascinating to us. End of the Rainbow, about the final months of Garland's life, opened last Friday at the Milwaukee Repertory Theater. The 2005 play by Peter Quilter had a long run in London's West End. It also had a Broadway run in 2012, and it's been performed in many other playhouses around the world. The day before opening, I sat down with Quilter, Milwaukee Rep's Mark Clements, who directed the production, and Chicago-based actress Hollis Resnick, who stars as Garland. Speaking in the lobby of the Powerhouse Theater, Quilter began the conversation by explaining why he chose to write about Garland's last few months.
Oh, purely for the drama of it. It was extraordinary to me that nobody had actually written it before, because the car crash of different things that were going on at the same time in her life at that period was just amazing to me. It was the most dramatic thing that, as an idea, that I'd ever come across. I mean, she's the most loved woman in the world, still trying to find love for herself in her personal life. One of the world's great performers, often performing terribly. A woman desperate to find joy and happiness in her life, but struggling with alcohol and drugs. And all those things all going on at once in a hotel room in London during a six-week concert period. And to me, it was just, it just had to be written. I thought the whole atmosphere of what was going on at that time, that like I say, that huge car crash of different things happening, was just electrifying. And I thought it would just make really good theatre, because not only do you have that really dramatic, compelling situation and a fascinating, complex woman, but you also have an opportunity to bring all her music into the show and to see her perform and to hear those songs. And so I thought it was a show that really just had to be written.
And Hollis, that puts such a pressure on you, because here is this icon that a lot of us think we know, and you're having to produce her on stage with that music and with, as Peter says, that car crash of things that were happening to her.
Yes. Well, I have played other women before that have lived, real people that have had disastrous lives. Piaf, Edie Biel of the Biel sisters, and Patsy Cline, Ava Perón. So when you do a role like this, there's always a lot of fascinating research you can do. Not only do you have the wonderful text of the playwright and the music and her body of work, but you know, you have a lot of research, a lot of video, a lot of interviews and things to pull from. So you get a real cushion of information and support for more than what's just given to you when you're rehearsing the play. So you feel supported in an extra way, which is a great, great help in terms of making choices about just emotional intent and what's happening in the moment in the person's life.
And I would think it also would help you prevent yourself from trying to do an imitation.
Well, I can't. I don't know how to do that. I can certainly give a quality, an essence, perhaps a similar sound in places. It all depends on, you know, where one's voice and own personal gifts lie. And I don't have a fat voice like she does. But, you know, I've been doing this long enough, and I have a good enough ear that technically I can incorporate some things. Plus, you're helped considerably by, you know, a particular wig or costume or sort of image that, you know, people have certainly seen before in the press or on film.
I belong to London. I'll skip this lyric. They'll be applauding. It's a part of me. It's a heart of me. Lambeth Walk to Leicester Square. I'm happy and so shoo shuffle then. 'Cause I belong to London. It's always been my cup of tea. North or south, east or west, bloody bloody blah best. On that march we must be getting agree. Yes, I've seen Paris and Rome. I get a feeling I'm
coloured.
By the London Rhine, always.
And Mark, for you, bringing this to stage, what are some of the challenges?
The play's action moves swiftly between
primarily the talk of the town, which was the premier night spot in the UK at that time where Judy was performing. And the hotel suite, which she stayed at the Ritz-Carlton in London. So we have to move effortlessly backwards and forwards between those things. So that was one big challenge technically, but I got a brilliant designer, Dan Conway, who has made that, you know, move it seemingly effortlessly, and kind of we pulled that off. That was something I really wanted to do. And certainly from the production that I'd seen previously that was on Broadway and in the West End, which was the same production ostensibly, they hadn't had that element, and I really missed that from a directorial point of view when I saw it, so I really wanted to pull that off, so we did that. And then, you know, the biggest challenge really with this play, I think, is making sure, you know, they would say a director's job is done, 70% of it isn't done in the casting, you know, and I think on this particular play, that's definitely true. You know, you need somebody who can... who's got the chops to do it, to hold the stage for 2 hours, who can pay fitting tribute at appropriate level to an icon. And when we started on this process, I was, you know, talking to Hollis about it, and she wasn't available at first, and then we sort of, you know, she was interested, and we went backwards and forwards, and I went to see her on tour while she was in Dallas doing Sister Act, and kind of we sat down afterwards, and I was like, you got to do this role, and so we kind of worked it out. Normally, I wouldn't program a piece like this unless I knew who was actually going to play it, but I don't know. I just had a good vibe about it. And I'd seen Hollis when I first moved to this area in Chicago, and I really wanted to work with her, and we vibed well. And so, yeah, I'm glad it worked out.
Well, and this is the first time in almost 20 years that you've been on the stage, right?
Yes, yeah. I came here to do plays. I did Shakespeare and Alan Ayckbourn and Tennessee Williams here. Tom Stoppard, yeah. Yes. And they weren't doing musicals again. And since Mark's begun his tenure here, he's sort of incorporated, a new vibe around here, which is great and exciting for Milwaukee audiences. People love smart musical theater. And, you know, not only do they have the cabaret here, which is great, but, you know, now they're able to produce exceptional musical theater storytelling, which, of course, is very close to my heart in many ways.
Gee, I'd like to see you looking swell. Baby, diamond bracelets, Woolworths doesn't sell. Baby.
Well, Peter, is this really a musical theater piece, or is it a play with music?
It's. I always call it a play with music, or sometimes I use the term musical drama, because it really is halfway between the two. I mean, it's not a musical in the sense that every 5 minutes everybody bursts into song, kicks their legs in the air. But, I mean, it does have a really strong musical element, because obviously, you know, we want to see her perform, we want to see Judy perform in those concerts. But the songs, where they come in the play and what the actual song is always a reflection of either what's going on in Judy's head emotionally at the time, or it's a comment on what has happened in the previous scene. So I was very careful in the songs that were selected. But fortunately, it worked fine for the story of the show, that I was able to incorporate The Man That Got Away and Over the Rainbow and other really, they're just amazing, amazing songs. I love sitting in the auditorium and hearing them, because it's the word, I didn't write any of those words, so I can just sit back and relax for 4 minutes, which is, you know, always nice. And so, you know, it's really is halfway between the two. I mean, people that love musical theatre will really enjoy the show. Judy Garland was one of the greats. These songs were classic songs, so they'll have a really good time. But also people who really like strong emotional drama will also, you know, get a real kick out of it. You know, they shouldn't feel, people that don't like musicals shouldn't feel that they're not going to like it, you know. I think it's a show that mixes both. And also the great thing about it is that Judy Garland was really funny. She was a really funny woman. And so although the story is occasionally dark and sad, it's always has a light touch, because Garland was one of those women that could just floor a room with a comment or a gag or everything. And she was funny, funny, funny all the time. Even when terrible things were going on, she managed to come out with these great zingers and one-liners and things. And that's great about the show. It gives it real energy, because it's not a desperately sad show. It's actually quite an upbeat show, because of the music element and also because of her personality, which was, you know, she was always fighting for happiness. She was always fighting to be joyful, even though everything was crumbling around her. And so it's, I think it's, for me, it's a really exciting show. I love watching it, because I just think she was just a fascinating woman, and the music is incredible. And so I just really enjoy sitting there watching the show, which is unusual for a playwright. Normally we crawl into corners and want people to cover us in lots of coats so we don't have to see or hear anything, you know. But I love watching the show. And I think it's important to point out that this is actually the first original American production of the show. The show that went to Broadway was the British production. Milwaukee Rep is the first company to do an original American production of End of the Rainbow. So it's a really big deal. I mean, this is why I'm here. It's, you know, we had lots of theatres that wanted to be first to do it. And I've known Mark 20 years and, you know, we went straight to him and I'm thrilled to be here. And I mean, I saw the show in the first preview. It's fantastic. I mean, you know, I would have gone straight home if it wasn't. I mean, but it's, you know.
You wouldn't be having this interview.
I wouldn't be having this interview. You know, I'd be on trying to get a plane out of Chicago. It's really great. Hollis is fantastic. And the whole production's just really, really, really hot.
So for you, are the zingers fun? Is that fun to play?
Well, I'm getting there.
Yeah.
I'm getting there. You know, I know that she's very funny, but so much of the text is powerful, angst and drama and pain, that it takes a while for an actor to really find the balance in that kind of text, you know, and in the relationships with the other actors. For my money, I always feel like I need another week in the rehearsal hall. I always feel a bit thrown to the wolves. So it, for me, it's always a process. It's always a matter of discovery.
You never finish.
Never.
Right.
No graduation.
Well, you hope not. No. You hope not because you hope that it keeps evolving as the show plays out its run.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. It's a living, breathing thing. It crackles.
Well, we're in a place of safety in the rehearsal room, you know, where everything is possible, where we can change things, where we can stop and start and move again. You know, once we're out there in the preview situation, you know, we had our second preview last night, and it was a very, very different audience to the first one. So the actors are learning a different dynamic because, you know, the timing of everything, especially when it evolves around music, when it evolves around comedic timing, those beats are different every night because you can't, they're determined by the audience. You know, if somebody coughs on your punchline, if somebody's cell phone goes off, then happens all the time in theaters now, unfortunately, it changes the dynamic in the room. And they, you know, it's a bit like, you know, playing tennis. Once, you know, you get a rhythm going, you get a, you know, a rally going, and then it's hard once that ball is dropped, then you have to start again. You have to create that rhythm every time. So we're learning to do that around what we've already learned around the text and our particular interpretation of that text. It was interesting that Hollis is also the first American to play this iconic role because the other actresses were Australian and English. So it's kind of fun to have bring it home.
So no pressure at all. Yeah, none at all for you. Yeah. Well, I want to thank you, all three of you, for taking time this morning to talk with me and break a leg.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you
very much. Thank you.
Hollis Resnick stars as Judy Garland in the play With Music, End of the Rainbow, written by Peter Quilter and directed by Mark Clements, also the artistic director of the Milwaukee Repertory Theater. End of the Rainbow runs through February 9th in the Powerhouse Theater. There's more information, including a slideshow of production photos, at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. And I'm Bonnie North. Thanks, as always, for tuning in. Be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned now. Fresh air is next.
And the dreams that you dare